You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNRadio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another letter left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Rob Bell. Rob is the author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestsellers What We Talk About When We Talk About God, The Zimzum of Love, Love Wins, and What is the Bible. His podcast, called The Robcast, was named by iTunes as Best of 2015. He's been profiled in The New Yorker, toured with Oprah, and in 2011, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He has a regular show at Largo, the legendary comedy and music club in Los Angeles, where he lives with his wife, Kristen, and their three kids. He has a new book. It's called Everything is Spiritual, Who We Are, and What We're Doing Here. Rob Bell, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
So there are so many ways I connected with this book, but let me just throw out a few to you. I grew up in the Midwest, and I was a soccer player who also played in a few rock bands. I always had a penchant for public speaking and started out as a dishwasher at Second City and became the youngest producer in the history of that theater in 1992. And at the peak of my career in 2015, I walked away from my dream job to basically find myself anew and ended up finding a way to blend my expertise in comedy and improvisation with science, and in particular, in my case, behavioral science. Oh, and I saw Midnight Oil play at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago during the Diesel and Dust Tour.
No, we were at the same show.
Yep.
No way.
I mean, I don't know if they did multiple nights that week.
Let's just assume they didn't.
Let's assume they didn't. The Aragon Ballroom. It was funny. I was telling my son Nick about this, and that was his first indoor concert when we saw the Avett Brothers there.
Oh, that is just fantastic. That is great.
Yeah, a lot of parallels. You went to school, college in Chicago?
Yeah, Wheaton.
Oh, you went to Wheaton. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, the Belushi boys are from that area.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
At the end of your book, you talk about how you begin this book, which is with these few words. My grandma kept cash in her bra. All right, that's an arresting image. And talk to us about why you start that way.
Often when we explore where we come from, it's easy to get stuck in a sort of nostalgia. It's easy to get stuck in the past, as opposed to seeing your past and all the people you come from and the places you come from and all the weirdness and oddness. Instead of seeing it all as a marvel, as a wonder, as look at where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have met so many people over the years who are almost, they're almost hobbled or they're almost inhibited by all of the things from their past they don't quite know what to do with. But you could also read it a completely different way. Like, look at all the strange things I've been a part of. Look at all the things that fell apart. Look at all the things that made no sense. And yet I'm here. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the things in the book, there's nothing more powerful to me than when somebody owns every square inch of their story. So there may have been abuse. There may have been horrible things. There may have been tragedy, trauma. It can still be those horrible things, and yet you're here. What a wondrous existence this is, that we even made it to whatever this moment is. There's something childlike about that wonder and awe. In some ways, it's the crisis of the modern world, is no one wants to be cynical. No one wants to have a hard heart. It's not really what you want. What you want is a sense of wonder and awe about your life.
I don't, when I schedule the podcast, it's very random. It's when people are available. I've just had such incredible luck in terms of the cadence of these conversations. So I just interviewed Sanford Greenberg, who is an 80-something year old inventor, philanthropist, who in his junior year in college, and this is the early 60s in Columbia University, went blind. And his roommate convinced him to come back to school, and he would help read to him. And his roommate was Art Garfunkel, who was studying to be an architect.
Oh, what a story.
And the way that this man looks back on a life of a lot of tragedy and trauma is with this sort of like unbridled joy. And he says, the only thing worthwhile in the world, I think, are people and ideas.
That's great.
Yeah. And so you start the story rooted in people with pain, your people rooted with pain.
Yeah. Cause we all come from somebody, some bodies.
Yeah.
There are these people we come from, and they were probably doing the best they could given what they were handed. And there's some deep wonder and gratitude for our roots.
Mm-hmm.
That is all part of it. And it's all the people who inspire us seem to be always people who they tell us where they come from in such a way that they've owned it all. Yeah, this is how the story went.
Yeah.
They're not repressing it or denying it or avoiding it. They tell you what happened. And it's like fresh air. Like, hey, you can just name all of it. It's okay.
Right.
Okay. There's something empowering, inspiring about that.
And it was interesting too, because when you talk about your grandma and where you grew up, you say, quote, they didn't come from a culture where you talk about your pain. So
yeah,
this is a big thing. And we had a tragedy in our family. We lost our 17-year-old daughter last year to cancer.
Oh
yeah.
Wow.
And I will tell you, and I've talked a lot in the podcast, my way through was I wrote about it every day. I journaled publicly about it every day. I talked about it with people on my podcast. And those conversations were just the lifeboat to moving through the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's been a year.
A year, August 1st.
And are you still writing about it? Or did you write it out?
I wrote for the year. I stopped writing the Daily Journal publicly about, I don't know, 4 months ago or so. Because I felt like I had taken that trip as far as I could take it. Because it moved into the grief. It went from chronicling to a grief journal.
Yeah.
I'm in a different place now.
It's almost like you wrote it out. Like it flushed it out of your...
Yeah.
Like it just, you wrote and wrote and wrote until it had gone through the system.
And just ironically or not, I mean, I quit writing just about a week before the world blew up. Right? That day in March when we're like,
sure.
Oh, we can't come to work? And then the social justice movement that comes out. Oh, okay. And so, yeah, I don't know that they're obviously not connected, but maybe they are in some way.
Well, the moment when everybody realized this isn't something that we're doing and then things are going to go back to normal. they're going forward into something we've never been in before.
Yeah, people are having a hard time with that.
You could see it start to tip from, this is a momentary pause, and then we'll all come back outside. You know, when things go back to normal, and people started saying, then it just became how things are, and then it became some new world that we're all headed into.
Yeah, kind of a collective trauma of sorts that we have now.
Yes.
I'm curious, are you familiar with the improvisational concept of Yes And? Do you know about
this? Of course. Oh, okay. Yes.
Because, man, this book, you write, quote, it's like an endless invitation, this experience that we're having here, and you can say yes over and over and over again. And you talk a lot about, you know, in improvisation, we say you should see all obstacles as gifts.
Absolutely.
And that is an overriding thesis is you sort of yelling, it's you yelling your yes out into the world and then discovering your and.
Yes. Yeah, so that's why I was in college and I went to an improv comedy night at a theater.
Mm-hmm.
The King Theater, I don't remember what it was called. And this was all new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a moment in the night when the crowd, anybody from the crowd could yell freeze and run up and stop it.
Mm-hmm.
A classic improv game.
Yep.
And I was watching this whole thing fascinated with it. And there was some scene, and I had no acting or performing or whatever background, but there was a scene, and suddenly, like an out-of-body experience, I heard myself yelling, freeze, and I ran down out of the crowd and tapped somebody and got them out of the scene and entered in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you obviously are a master at this. It was like channeling a bolt of lightning.
Yeah.
It was absolutely, completely terrifying, and I was like floating 3 inches above the stage. But I realize now something was beginning to form in me of, I do not want to live my life wondering what if.
Mm-hmm.
I had just seen too many people who had hunches, dreams, intuitions, lines of inquiry floating around in their head and heart, and they didn't follow it for whatever reason, and then years later they're wondering why their life isn't what they wanted it to be.
Right.
So it was somewhere starting there that something got formed in me. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do, don't live your life wondering what if.
Right.
Better to lose a ton of money and be hated and be a wreck, but not have that sense.
Yeah.
That's that. So improv was all in there. It all did something, ignited something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so happy that you, that's great that you picked up. Of course, an improv wizard would pick that up in the book.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, my main focus is applied improvisation, taking all the things that we do to train these incredible, talented people and bring it to caregivers or bring it to the business world or
work. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Do a lot of wellness work.
Mm-hmm.
And I refer to it as human being practice. It's one of those rare moments where we get to practice talking to each other, looking each other in the eye.
Yes.
Without a script. People don't think they're good improvisers. I'm like, you do it every day. You literally wake up improvising. So the other thing that I thought was really interesting, and I love how the book, so I read the book, I had a PDF. I could not tell if there were chapters or not, just the way it like came, which was really hilarious. So I roller coastered this thing and I decided to go with the flow. And you were talking about your parents when they bought the 600 square foot cabin in the UP. And this is where I think you sort of learned to sort of commune with nature and find the sort of awe-inspiring aspect of this world that we live in. And I was curious if you're familiar with the work of Robert McFarlane, the British writer.
I know. How do I know this name? His name is familiar.
So McFarlane, he's an English writer and scholar. He's got a bunch of really powerful books on landscape and nature and language. And I had actually just tweeted a quote that I found of his a few days before reading this part of your book. And he wrote, quote, "Paths are the habits of a landscape. They are acts of consensual making."
That's so good.
That's so good. And that's how you are talking about walking through nature. This is a collective. We're doing this together.
Yes, yes. And over the years, I've met so many people who were having profound experiences of awakening with creation, but weren't in environments that affirmed and confirmed those experiences. So something about this modern atomized 21st century capitalism on steroids world cut people off from the very real experiences they're having of connection and communion with everything that's everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as I sort of went back through my own story, I was like, oh yeah, I'm the soil on that farm, the woods, like and for many people, spirituality got so bound up in religion.
Yeah.
That when they did go to what would be seen as places to affirm these instincts, they were given doctrines and dogmas that actually separated them from things they already knew. So you either stay and you cut yourself off from what you actually know, or you leave and now you're left to think that somehow you're not connected. So it's like a part of it was going back through, oh, I've had this sense since way back.
Yeah. I had a wonderful mentor in college who was a former Jesuit monk. He had run away with a nun so they could get married, ended up being a college teacher. And he was the first one to expose me to that Buddhist analogy of the finger pointing at the moon and
yes.
worshiping the finger or the moon.
Yes, yes. You even think about it now, people will talk about just the utter insanity of like, well, the Democrats have the environmental policies. What? What? There's a group that thinks we should care for the earth? And there's a group, according to them, that don't? Like, what? How did something so essential to being human become thought of as a platform that you could either be for or against? It's just insanity.
Yeah. Well, this is what a global pandemic apparently is good for, is exposing a lot of these very muddy ideas that everyone was sort of like, oh, I guess that's the way the world works. And it's like, no, nope, yeah. Doesn't need to.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It, my wife, Kristen, and I, call it apocalyptic hope because yes. The word apocalypse literally means to reveal. So apocalypse is not necessarily a destruction. It's the revealing of what's been true the whole time.
Interesting.
And my boys and I have talked often about how the pandemic is like ripping the mask off. This is how it's been. It's just the knobs got turned up. And so you're just seeing some people resist facts. They've been resisting facts and science the whole time. It's just now being laid bare. Some people will profit on anything, including a rising death toll. That's been the truth along. You're just now having it revealed. And the idea behind hope is simply we can't together get where we're going to go until the truth is all laid bare, as painful and ugly and messy as it is.
Right. Can we go back to that Midnight Oil concert?
Oh, can we ever? Have you heard the new song, by the way?
They have a new song?
It came out, I don't know, a couple week ago, 2 weeks ago? First song in 17 years.
Wow. Well, he's out of politics now, right?
Yeah, and by the way, his autobiography is wonderful. It's like thicker than a Bible. It's massive. So there, yeah.
You write in the book that what it brought for you is both resistance and joy, defiance and euphoria. And this is duality that seems to be, you know, bubbling up in you at that time, but becomes really important as you, I title my little sections, and one of them was around like where I wrote seeing things in a new way. Like this seems like this journey of like, I'm seeing things in a new way, seeing things in a new way. And I don't know, I remember that concert in a very similar vein of tight craft with also just loose passion. I mean, it was all that, just colliding.
It had it. There was something combustible. They were like ruthless and fierce, but it had this, it was undergirded normally punk had that ruthless, fierce drive, but underneath it all was just tear the whole thing down.
Yep.
At some level. This had this different subtle animating energy of like love and joy and celebration, which but fierce and ruthless, and that ancient prophetic calling out the powers that be for their abuse and oppression. It was like I hadn't ever seen all those duct taped together before.
No. I was talking to Valerie Kaur, who's a Hindu activist. We had her a few weeks ago, and she talks about this radical love that she's approaching the world, which is hard and tangled and disruptive, yes, but it is love. And therefore you can never see someone as your enemy when you're seeing them as human.
Yeah. And for so many people, love like had no edges. It was squishy. It didn't have any borders or boundaries or spinal fortitude to it. And truth was the thing that had all the edges and all the... So to see a love that's strong and fierce and knows what it is, and it's okay to let people down because it's doing something very big and important here.
Yep.
Yeah. That was... I would have been 19. It's amazing how those moments shaped us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you had essentially what people would call a megachurch. I know you hate that term, but right?
Yes. I think in the book I talk about when that word started to get used about me, megachurch pastor, I would just wince like, no, I'm raging against the man. I'm not the man.
Right. But then you started like doing crazy things like talking about women and men being perhaps equal. Exploring the idea of love and sex. These really outlandish things that don't combine humans in any way or connect them. And you basically were, I mean, I think you decided to leave, right? They didn't decide to have you leave?
Oh yeah, that when I left, what was that, a decade ago?
Yeah.
It's like you... It's like a chapter. Like you just become aware. Oh, that was a wonderful chapter. Now it's done. Now we have to keep going. It wasn't a dramatic scandal. There wasn't any like these people rose up and it was. Well, in the book I talk about literally the leaders of the church were like, "What do you want to do next?" And what do we want to do next? And the answer had always been, "We'll stay here and we'll just keep doing what we're doing here." And suddenly it was like it cracked open a door. Well, keep going. And my work, I had just had so many experiences where my work had some sort of extra voltage to it when it wasn't in a place that was labeled religious or, like when I started touring in clubs, you're in Chicago.
Yep.
So I remember the first time I did the Vic.
Yep.
Empty Bottle.
Yes.
Where else? Not the Chicago Theater. There was an old theater. I don't know if it's still standing. But when I started touring, there was something about the work I was doing that it seemed to find its home in theaters and clubs and spaces. Mm-hmm. In spaces where we exchange ideas like comedians and plays and bands. Like it seemed to do best in the larger exchange of ideas. So let's follow that, see where it goes.
Well, yeah, and you talk about that moment where you sort of discover your voice inside that space, which is a voice that's sort of listening. My wife often refers to improvisation as being an art form that's in conversation with its audience.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think, and very much, it's like you're like we're all doing this together, which is it can be a unique experience inside a theater where you have a raised platform with artists who might, you know, deem superior. And you have to work really hard to break that down, to get people to not act like that audience, to the point that then, you know, reining them in can be difficult as well.
Yes, I always say the reason I love the shows I do when I go on tour is I'm witnessing to the show like the audience. I might have a microphone and I might actually be, I'm about to talk for 2 hours straight, but I'm also witnessing to it with you. And I know what's going to happen, and I also don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that boundary dissolved for me, and we're all merged, and it just becomes so much more. I'm not trying to make you laugh. I'm laughing. You're free to join.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that I think it's true too in our work, which is because people, when they find out you work at Second City, like, tell me a joke, and you know, we don't tell jokes.
Right.
Which is confusing to people because I think they think stand-up comedy. And in fact, no, I mean, what we are searching for is truth.
Yes.
And that's usually funny because we're surprised by it because we thought things, you know, that's the sort of divergent thinking aspect of the improvisational process is it uncovers in the very ordinary somewhat remarkable things.
It always strikes me about improv. In some ways, your job is to be fully present.
Yes.
Because if you're fully present, there'll be more than enough to laugh about.
Yeah.
If you're paying attention,
mm-hmm.
In the book, I talk about being in on the joke.
Yeah.
That's what we're all actually, that's where all the gold is.
Yeah. 100%. So when you were in therapy while you were still at your church, right? That was all part of the process of.
Oh, sure. Sure. It was like an amazing moment when somebody's like, you know, you could go to a therapist and like talk about what's going on inside of you. And I remember just what I would have been late 20s, early 30s. No way. I mean, this was what, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember like going and the therapist, like a trained professional on the interior life, just throwing out a few bits of wisdom and just being like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
We
had a very similar experience, which is I sense we have a similar demeanor in terms of like, oh, nice laid back person, doesn't get upset a lot. And my therapist was like, let's talk about your anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
What anger? What anger? And we found it.
Yeah. Yeah. Here I was like, no, joy. Like I'm fine. And all of a sudden I started peeling back these layers. It's like, oh yeah. Yeah. And that revelation that you didn't have to live with this giant churning hairball inside of you of like, why does this person set me off? And why do these situations put me on edge? And why does that memory fill me with such a sense of confusion? Like you could follow it and like follow those threads and find out where they go. And it would all start to make a little more sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
20 years ago, that was just completely groundbreaking to me.
Do you still go to therapy?
There isn't a specific person, but I have a couple people that I go to on a regular basis who are, okay. I have a couple friends in that business. Actually my wife is about the best I've ever,
oh, that's nice.
So that's nice.
I hopefully she's not too expensive.
me a good deal.
I was thinking about so I get asked a lot of being a lot of panels. I'm sure you do too. And a lot of times they want you. They're like, okay, what is the if you had to say like one thing, you know, or one thing you've learned or what? And the thing I've been falling on lately is saying that we all think we're frauds. Like, believe me, like, I don't care. And actually, anyone who doesn't is probably a sociopath. You know, you and I both know who I'm talking about. But this sort of, it's a great evener, which is like, everyone is upset about something. Everyone rues their mistakes. We all live in this world of tumult inside. And, you know, there is a better way. And your book is certainly leading us to that. It's as much saying it's already there, right? It's already there. You can work with what you got. It's not something that's far off. You don't have to go to a mountain.
Right.
And that is, I don't know if that sells well, but I appreciated it.
Oh, I think everybody deep down intuitively knows this is true. And I think it's water in the desert. Like because so much of the modern world is constructed around the sacred other. It's the thing that if you just had it, then you'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about the internet, billions of dollars are being spent to draw your eyeballs into internet advertising.
Yeah.
Like, never have human beings been subject to this kind of targeted, energetic focus on getting you to give your eyeballs to something so that you would consume, built on a foundation of there's something, if you had it, then your life would be better. That is the sacred other in its expansive commercialized form. And every ancient wisdom tradition is the exact opposite, which is everything you've ever needed, you already have.
Yeah.
So you have a modern system in direct opposition to what human beings have known and lived for thousands of years. That will create some tension and conflict. But in my experience, people are starving to be reminded of the ancient truths.
Mm.
You're okay. I mean, think of how many people in the past few years are using the word meditate that didn't use the word meditate, which is to sit in emptiness and formless silence and experience more than if you owned everything you ever wanted to own. This emptiness and silence is actually more full than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the science around mindfulness and
absolutely. My daughter's school begins the day with mindful coloring. She's now in sixth grade. When she was in third grade, she'd go to school and they'd begin the day with mindful coloring. It's like, there we go.
Yep. Wow.
Yep, we are returning to the ancient ways.
Good. Good. We need to do something. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but I do want to delve into your nerd love of quantum physics, which is, I'm on the behavioral sciences. That's where I've been spending my time for the last four or 5 years. I love it. I understand it. I get in there and it's very, so human behavior centered, which is improvisation. But quantum physics, like, I mean, you find so many analogies to the Bible and that surprised me at first.
Yeah. The idea that what quantum physicists are now telling us about how creation actually is, that everything's made of atoms, atoms made of particles, particles are tiny bits and pieces of energy that come and go in patterns that we kind of understand and kind of don't, that relationship is actually what the universe is at its core.
Mm-hmm.
Ancient mystics have been talking like this for thousands of years. And in some ways, they're talking about different dimensions, exterior objective versus interior subjective. So in some ways, it's important not to cross those beams. But in other ways, we have a long history of mystics, sages, and artists intuitively describing how the world is, and then science catching up with objective language. I mean, if you read the 12th century Sufi mystic Rumi, like, I'm sure you've read Rumi.
Oh, yeah.
Rumi's describing quantum elements to the world 800 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's always been this interplay between what we sense and then the data and the metrics to actually prove it, which I think that dance alone is absolutely fascinating.
There's a line from the book, which actually, if you put it in a series of Rumi quotes, you might think it is, which is, when a particle travels, it appears to take every possible path to get where it's going until it's observed. Then it reveals the path it took. Right? What an incredible piece of wisdom.
Yes. That's yes. Science. And that was the thing for me, is stumbling into quantum physics as just a guy off the street, and it's speaking to the heart in some strange way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that for me was a massive revolution.
One of the, when I started working with behavioral scientists and started picking up on various theories and ideas, I remember we were talking about an improvisation. We often talk about the need to be others focused as a way to do our work. My friend Heather, when she was at U of C, turned me on to this concept of self-verification theory. And the idea is that most of us, we think we want to be seen as our best selves and our prettiest selves or our smartest selves, but that's not true. What self-verification theory shows us is that we want to be seen as we see ourselves. So if I see myself as clumsy, I need you to see me as clumsy so you won't throw me a ball.
Wow.
Isn't that
kind of a
different twist?
Yes.
It explains why people date assholes. I mean, that's what I took out of it.
That's what you took away. That's what your summary of SVT, as I like to say.
Yes. Is that a scratch? but it's like, oh, you see yourself in some sort of, I had a bad first marriage and I definitely feel like, oh, I think I saw myself as being a little bit lesser than, and this person confirmed that for me.
Wow. Which is why when we think about the moments that most shaped us, often somebody came along and told us something different. They're like, hey, you're actually better than that.
Well,
I thought appropriately disruptive.
Yep. And I thought about this when you talked about meeting your wife, because when I met my wife, Anne, the analogy I use all the time was it felt like getting glasses for the first time and you could see definition on trees.
Oof. Yeah.
And you talk you're very close in your analogy to that in terms of meeting your wife.
Yeah. There was, Kristen loved me exactly as I was and required nothing of me, which in some strange way motivated me to be more than I was.
Right.
There was this inherent paradox. She was a woman and a conundrum. Like an experience of the divine and like another human being. It was all at the same time.
I mentioned Sanford Greenberg earlier, and one of the things he talks about when you're blind is you have to learn just to live your life in trust, because you just have to trust people.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he's really only been let down a few times, and I'm like, that's pretty good. If you're trusting everyone. And I like to think that, you know, our cynicism would lead us to think, oh no, everyone would take advantage. But here's a guy who's lived, you know, a long, long life and with immense amount of trust, and it worked.
Yeah. And this is somebody has to make the first move.
Mm-hmm.
So these patterns, we bomb that country, that bomb country bombs us. We don't feel safe. So we bomb them again. They bomb us because now they don't feel safe. And so this man who is blind at a young age breaks the cycle.
Yeah.
He breaks the cycle of cynicism and distrust.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has to make the first move and invulnerability, trust, and then it breaks the loop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's how long-term relationships get better and better over time. It's how systems and communities and healthy relational spaces work, is somebody is willing to break the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it unleashes all this new energy and new things get created. Wow, that's a good story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love this guy. All right. So before we went on the air here talking, I was saying your book is such a giant yes and that I felt silly even asking you for it, but I'm going to go ahead. And
I already told you that one improv story.
Yep.
That was like a yes and.
So the concept here with the various guests is that, you know, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. That's what we're doing in our work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if you think you have another one in you in terms of a yes and story.
Yeah, okay. For years, I would do these workshops for communicators where, because everybody in all kinds of different work is just trying to get better able to give language to whatever it is they're feeling, thinking, activists, CEOs, artists, writers, etc. And so I've been doing these events where I would teach for a couple days straight on good communication, et cetera, and then people would ask questions. And I got this idea, what if you didn't prepare anything and you walked in the first day? These people come from all over the world to Los Angeles. Come in the first day, put two chairs up front, and just invite somebody to come up front and sit knee to knee with you and just tell you what they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me that No, prepare. I prepare 2 days worth of stuff. I don't want to be left floating. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I want to, all the stuff. I want to make sure they get their money's worth. I want to make sure I deliver. I want to make sure I give them all the, but it was like, no more to say yes to this idea. Go in with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And just completely open yourself up, fully present, knee to knee. So I walk in the first day at 9 a.m. I say, is anybody working on something and you're stuck? Anybody here just stuck and we just need to get you unstuck just to start things? And like a couple hands go up. So somebody comes up and they tell me how they're stuck. And the only way it worked is to stay completely present and just listen and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, it was like magic. Well, you know.
Yeah, it works.
It was magic. And I think for me and the creating I've done over the years, it was like for years I would bring the content into the room. Like, oh, I've got these outlines. I've got these things I'm going to say. Oh, they're going to, this teaching is going to be great. And then to go in with nothing, almost like spatially, the content's already in the room. Mm-hmm. All of the magic is, it's already in the room. I'm just going to sit here and be open to it.
Yeah.
And it completely transformed. I was going to say those events, but maybe I think that my life is probably the better.
Right. Well, because you're not walking in with nothing, because you're walking in with everything.
Everything. My entire life experience. And there are moments literally where the person, I'd be listening to the person, basically just holding up a mirror to them.
Yeah.
Do you notice your shoulder slouch when you said that? So you probably don't want to do that. Like, I'm just observing. But there were moments when I would break into a story from when I was just saying, can I tell you a story? And for some reason, pull up a story from when I was 13 that I hadn't thought about since I was 13, which was mm-hmm. the story for mm-hmm. this person in this moment. Just the absolutely spontaneously surreal ways in which the fullness of my own life, this person's life, the other people in the room, sometimes I would pause with the person and just say, hold on, anybody in the room have anything to say to them? And there would be somebody with that particular smile. And she, yeah. And then they would say the exact thing. Yeah. But I had this, there was like this, no, we don't just go in like that. Mm-hmm. No way, man. That's not how you do your, okay. Yes. And let's, yeah. So there's a chance I could see you at the Vic in a couple of years, and I just walk out on stage and go, anybody stuck?
Exactly. And I'm sure I'm going to be stuck on something. I'm stuck on something right now, but we're working on it. The book is called Everything is Spiritual, Who We Are and What We're Doing Here. Rob Bell, thank you for coming on the show.
It was so great, and I'm so glad that you read it and we talked. I loved what you had to... You told me things about the book.
Oh, good.
Getting the S.A.N. is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feet pounding at the ground each week.
survive.